We live in an incredible world today. Things that just a couple of decades ago were never imagined are now a reality. Amazing applications from our electronic age can be used to provide both positive benefits and, on the other hand, also bring about some curses. I'm sure that most of us are familiar with the internet site that's called YouTube. God's Church has recently been employing it as one of the most effective tools, actually, in the spread of the gospel. I often use YouTube when I want to know how to build or repair something. I'm not naturally very good at that, and unfortunately Mr. Schrock has moved away, so I now have to go to find a way to demonstrate how to do those things. And if you need to know how to lay down a tile floor, for example, no problem. Somebody, and most likely even dozens of people, have, from do-it-yourselfers to experts, have decided to spend the time to record their own experiences in the form of videos that demonstrate how to do the entire process. Generally, they're not real formal presentations. They're just someone who would ad-libs online. They've got a video camera. You may need to find a few minutes looking through quite a few of those to find the one that that explains the process easy enough. But when you do, you'll probably be able to see all the different steps and how to do something. Last year, I got a couple of good ideas on how to modify a kayak that I had purchased by watching just some average people. They were proud of what they had made, and they wanted everybody to see what they had done. But by the same token, this same YouTube media can be used for sometimes less than useful purposes, and sad to say, sometimes for evil. It's really no wonder when we think about what God said in the Bible about the Garden of Eden and the two trees. The forbidden tree was described as the tree of good and evil. That's what man's way has been throughout history. Some good mixed with evil, and sometimes even quite a bit of evil. In this last week, I was researching material for this message, and it led me to a particular subject on the internet. The reference said that if you wanted to know more or to see it firsthand, then go to this example of it on YouTube. So I did. And they were right. There were quite a few multiple videos fully demonstrating the process that I was looking up. I'll explain what it was in a moment, but now probably the adult in this room probably have never heard of this particular activity, and I had not, but it's likely that some of the kids and the teens may be familiar with it. You'll have to ask them later. Hopefully, at worst, they'll say they've heard of it, but hopefully never tried it. Well, what I want to talk about today is social pressure. In years past, what we would have called it peer pressure. And generally, we mainly focused on teens and young adults when we called it that. But social pressure can be exerted on everyone, regardless of whether they're teenage, preteens, young adults, middle ages, and even seniors can all be affected by social pressure. It's just that in most cases, young people, partly because of their lack of experience, seem to be more susceptible to pressure than others. Although we'll see in a few minutes that's not always the case. But we'll see that they're certainly not the only ones affected by social pressure. I've entitled this sermon, Fighting Societal Pressures. And we'll explore this subject by looking at some examples in the Bible of those that were under pressure, some of whom successfully fought it and some who did not. And we'll finish by reviewing some of the instructions that God gives us that can be helpful when resisting the pressures of society and staying faithful to God. So getting back to that activity that I was referring to, it's something that I would never have dreamed of doing. You'll probably think that it's pretty much senseless at best, and of course you'd be right. But lots of young people have felt compelled to try it for themselves. So what is it? It was called the Salt and Ice Challenge. I don't see anybody that looks like they might have heard it. Here's a description of what some young people are being challenged by their peers to do. The challenge involves nothing more than a handful of salt and some ice cubes. The participants pour the salt into their hand or on some other part of their body, and then they add ice cubes. Some simply close their fist and see how long they can hold it. They can hold it closed. Others actually have friends press the salt and ice mixture onto their skin and hold it. The object seems to be to see who has the highest tolerance for pain and can withstand the burning pain the longest. Teens are giving themselves second and third degree burns with this so-called game. You would not think that the mixture of ice cube and salt would have any effect. But I found one video that had been viewed over 1.3 million times. There were two teenagers who were participating who stated that they didn't know what was going to happen. I'm not sure that I believe that. They voiced the opinion that it didn't sound very dangerous to them, and I think most of you would agree that it doesn't particularly sound very dangerous, even though some of their friends had told them otherwise. But they jokingly said that they wanted to try it for themselves, and after just a few seconds of filming, they were both in quite obvious pain. But they kept it up as long as they could stand it. By the end of the video, both of them appeared to have some rather severe chemical burns. I don't pretend to know what the chemical explanation for this is, but apparently it certainly does have that effect. Well, why did they do this? What was the motivation? Mostly that friends that they knew seemed to be trying it. Despite what they were being told, it just didn't make sense that it could be really that bad. They had to try it for themselves. Well, unfortunately, that wasn't the only social trend that I found in doing this research. There were numerous others. These are the kind of pressures that society has for young people nowadays, like one called eyeballing. And I'm not sure if you've heard of that one. Eyeballing involves pouring a shot of hard liquor into one's eye socket. I see some of you cringing. That's the same reaction I had. Eyeballing can cause irritation, swelling, corneal scarring, and blindness even. Several of these current trends seem to be focused on finding new ways to getting hard alcohol into the body, other than just the obvious, just drinking it, which is something that parents don't particularly like. I'll give you a couple more trends that I heard of or read. Have you ever heard of chat roulette? It's rated as the number one most dangerous teen fad, at least in one place. It's essentially a type of Skype where anyone, adults, teens, kids, can video chat with random strangers any time of day, 24 hours a day. It seems anonymous, but the participants can easily, and they're often encouraged, to reveal personal information that could allow someone else to locate them. And they have no idea who's on the other end of the video screen. The last one that I'll mention has been in the news just the last couple weeks, if you've read any local news or any national news. A recent headline about it read, "New eyeball licking fetish spreading pink eye among Japanese adolescents." Pink eye has been spreading among Japanese school children as a result of a new bizarre fetish, eyeball licking. The curious act, known as oculinitis, is described as an expression of intimacy among young lovers. One of the accounts was from a Japanese middle school teacher who said that up to 10 children in his classroom were wearing eye patches to school. The teacher said he finally understood the reason for the rise in eye problems when he witnessed a male student licking a female student's eye in the school gymnasium. After yelling at them to stop, the couple explained to the teacher that they had recently started dating and they wanted to move beyond just kissing. It seems that this trend may have originated with a music video by a band in Japan. Now, God's church has for years taught that there are three sources of sin that we have to contend with in this age. One is Satan, the devil, obviously. Next is our own carnal nature. And lastly, the society around us. Now, when we say Satan, we're talking about the direct spiritual impact that Satan has on mankind. That's primarily the introduction of ungodly thoughts into our mind. Satan is referred to as the prince of the power of the air in Ephesians 2, verse 2. And he seemingly can transmit negative thoughts and emotions in a way that humans can receive spiritually. The second source of sin is when we are led by our own carnal desires, and when we fail to control those desires or lusts. The Bible says in Romans 8, verse 7, that the carnal mind is enmity against God and not subject to God. But the third source, the society around us, also presents a very strong influence on us. in this present age, it seems that societal pressures have become almost overwhelming for some people and lead many directly into sin. In the past, at least in the United States, and only to a limited degree, the impact of society could occasionally be described as neutral or in some cases even positive. If you go back to the earlier days of this nation, say 50 years ago and further, well before some of us were born, there was a time when there was some respect for God, and there were societal pressures that were exerted by schools, churches, and hard as it is to believe now, even the government. And these all, to some degree, reinforced limited biblical teachings that were given to people and their families. Unfortunately, we're seeing that more and more of the pressure to conform with evil agendas rather than positive ones. Organizations like the Boy Scouts, as you've probably heard recently, Big Brother and Big Sister, and others that once had a somewhat positive influence on society are increasingly being forced to bow to what is everybody's familiar with, political pressure, or political correctness, I should say. That generally means that they've thrown out any moral standards and all references to God. We find that from an early age, even from 5 or 6 years old now, all the way up to even senior citizens, that there are intense social pressures to conform to many ungodly activities and even ways of thinking. Just look at the immodest clothing styles that teens and even very young girls are beginning to wear. So let's ask ourselves, do you and I imagine that we're exempt from pressures from society? If you do, you may need to re-examine that conclusion. Here's a simple example. Have you ever felt the strong urge to clap at an event because others are around you, even though you don't necessarily agree with what they're doing? We've even seen this at church services. At the feast, we're all requested, from the very start of the feast, not to applaud for special music. But invariably, there will be a song or a performance that some people just have to feel they have to respond to. I'm not saying there's necessarily any sin attached to the applause, but my point is that we all feel pressured to respond just as the few that have started to applaud. In this instance, in a church service setting, we're mostly able to resist that urge to conform. But do we always have that strength to resist it? I can think of many times in my life when I've gone against pressures, gone against my preferences because of pressures from others. To this day, I regret that in my early 20s, I was kind of compelled to join a labor union at work under pressure. A union rep informed me that I could expect to have my tires flattened if I chose not to join. It wasn't a sin, but I was certainly being pressured into doing something against my better judgment. How strong would peer pressure have to be for us to go against our beliefs? Are you confident that you can withstand pressure that's exerted by others? I have 3 videos that I want to show you now, all of which have examples of peer pressure in them. The first one is somewhat humorous, but it makes a simple point. The next 2 get progressively more troubling as you see the potential effect that social pressure can have on individuals. Now, as you watch these, put yourself in the place of the subject and ask how you think you would respond to each of these individual situations. Now, the first one is very simple, and I'm going to have to step away from this in a second and turn it on. It's about some people who are in an elevator. And you'll see the reactions that they have and what they're being asked to conform to. The next 2 are actually conformity experiments. One was done, I think, some years ago. I think you can tell by the clothing that the people are wearing that it probably was from the 60s or 70s. And the third is a more recent one that I think was done in Britain somewhere. And it's also interesting and somewhat troubling, the reaction that these people have. So if you give me a moment, I'm going to step away and turn some light down and turn these videos on. I'll play one after the other, and then we'll come back in and conclude.
Thank you. The gentleman in the elevator now is a candid star. These folks...
Years ago. Now let's see if group pressure still applies today at the elevators at the University of South Florida's library.
I might just explain, because I cut off a little bit at the beginning. Actually, the beginning was from a candid camera episode quite a few years ago. But in each of these episodes, the instances, there's one student who's the subject that does not know that he's a subject, and the other students who are entering the elevator have all been told to turn a certain direction. So the one who enters first is generally the one who doesn't realize that he's being pressured into doing something very simple. As I said, that was somewhat humorous. It was interesting, the gentleman in the blue, that he was pressured, so he wasn't even going to leave the elevator until the rest of the people left. So But I don't know how many people they went through that may have resisted that, but it was rather humorous watching those. But now, again, as I said, the next two are experiments that were done. And this first one was done, again, in the mid-60s or 70s.
But an experiment is not a public opinion poll. It examines behavior under the pressure of social forces, as the experiment of Solomon Asch reveals.
The experiment you'll be taking part in today involves the perception of lengths of lines. As you can see here, I have a number of cards, and on each card there are several lines. Your task is a very simple one. You're to look at the line on the left and determine which of the three lines on the right is equal to it in length. All right, we'll proceed in this order. You'll give your answer.
Only one of the people in the group is a real subject, the fifth person with the white t-shirt. The others are confederates of the experimenter and have been told to give wrong answers on some of the trials. The experiment begins uneventfully as subjects give their judgments.
Two.
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 Three.
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 Three. Three.
But on the third trial, something happens.
Two.
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 The subject denies the evidence of his own eyes and yields to group influence.
One.
Asch found subjects went along with the group on 37% of the critical trials. One. But he found through interviews that they went along with the group for different reasons.
One.
One.
They must be right. There are four of them and one of me.
One.
This subject's yielding is based on a distortion of his judgment. He genuinely believes that the group is correct.
One.
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 Two.
One.
Two.
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 I know they're wrong, but why should I make waves?
Two.
In this case, the subject knows he is right, but goes along to avoid the discomfort of disagreeing
Two.
With the group. Here, the distortion is at the level of his response.
Two.
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 In the previous experiment, Two. The naive subject stood alone against the group.
Two.
In this variation, Asch gave the naive subject a partner, here seated in the third position, who also gives the correct response.
One.
One.
Two.
One.
Two.
With a partner, yielding drops to only 5% of the critical trials compared to 37% without a partner. Although subjects report warmth and good feeling toward the partner, they typically deny that he played a role in their own independence.
Two.
The partnership variation shows that much of the power of the group came not merely from its numbers, but from the unanimity of its opposition. When that unanimity is punctured, the group's power is greatly reduced. Sometimes we go along with a group because what they say convinces us they are right. This is called informational conformity. But sometimes we conform because we are apprehensive that the group will disapprove if we are deviant. This is called normative conformity. The strength of the normative factor is shown in another variation carried out by Asch. In this variation, the subject is told that because he had arrived late, he would have to write his answers. Subjects in this private response experiment are exposed to the same amount of misleading information as other subjects, but they are immune from any possible criticism by the group.
One.
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 And this enormously reduces the pressure to conform. Conformity drops by two-thirds.
Two.
Asch's experiment is a classic. It reveals how people will deny what they see and submit to group pressure. It allows us not only to observe conformity, but to study the conditions that increase or reduce its occurrence.
We've invited five strangers to take part in an experiment about peer pressure. They think they're helping a doctor with her research into group response times. They'll be asked to complete a three-dimensional puzzle as quickly as possible. And for research to be valid, it is vital that no one has done the puzzle before. But there are some things the group don't know. The first is that the doctor is an actor wearing a hidden mic. The second is that one of the group is also an actor who has done the puzzle before and who's going to encourage the others to cheat. The third is that they are being secretly filmed on hidden cameras. So how will the group respond? Will they collude with the actor? And will individuals in the group let themselves be persuaded by peer pressure to sabotage the doctor's supposedly scientific research?
What I want to do is to time your response into doing this puzzle here. It's very, very important that no one's done this puzzle before. Does anyone recognise it at all? That's excellent. Great. Okay. Can one of you volunteer to use this stopwatch? So as soon as you start, you just press this button here. And then once you've completed the puzzle, just press it again.
Okay.
All right? Great. Thank you. And can somebody else volunteer to use this bell here? Yep, great. So once you've finished the puzzle, can you just ring that and then I'll know when to come back in? Unravel it. So good luck and all the best, and I'll see you in about 5 minutes. All right?
Great.
3, 2, 1, go.
I'm totally hopeless. Well, my theory is blue is called C, so that'd be at the bottom. That is the ground, and that is the sky, the sun. So I think you look at it like that.
Excellent, you're doing
Are you good at these?
Yeah, did you get asked if you'd done this before we came in? Because I know how you, if we've only got 5 minutes, can I just quickly see? Because I had this at Christmas, and if it's the right thing, I think it would be quite fun if I can just remember quite how it works.
Although the actor makes it pretty obvious he's done the puzzle before, the group as a whole seem to go along with him. No one actually speaks out against the blatant cheat.
Rather a lot. Yeah, we could say it was two. Yeah, that's right. It's kind of teamwork, isn't it? I reckon that is kind of teamwork, kind of thing going on.
While the group wait for the doctor to return, they quickly discuss what their strategy will be to back up the actor's cheat. They are happy to collude with one another in a lie, although they have only just found out each other's names.
That's really fantastic. That's so, so quick. That is just fantastic. I think that's the fastest so far, actually, that any group of people have done it. So that's really, really amazing. I'm so impressed. That's incredible. That's great. So you should, that nobody's done this puzzle before. Yeah? Great. Thanks very much. Thank you.
The doctor has already given the group the chance to own up to the fact that one of them has cheated and sabotaged her research. She now gives each of them the chance to grass on the actor. And to make it easier for them, she gives them the chance to dish the dirt in private. But will they come clean?
I think the group went really, really fast.
We tried to, yes.
One of the fastest times, actually, that I've ever experienced before. So why do you think you were such a fast group?
Very early on, we sort of agreed that, you know, we wanted a certain approach to it.
And then the guy next to me, Ian, he picked up on that and he started to... I passed over one of the pieces to Ian and he started to put the pieces together from that.
I was just looking on in amazement. I think, well, what's it? Linda, mm-hmm. She had some insight about the sun going at the bottom or mm-hmm. something, and then Ian was pretty integral. I just let them do their thing. Yeah.
Do you think that no one had done this puzzle before?
Do I think that?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Because it was done.
It was
quite
done.
Fast.
Yeah. I don't know.
Why do you think it was so fast?
Because Ian knew how to do it. Because I think he's a plant, and I've been had.
Oh. So you think that Ian had done this puzzle before? Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
So, one of the group has seen through the deception. How will the others respond when we ask them what their motives have been for lying?
So did you hear me say you can't lie? I wasn't comfortable with it. But now, when she was asking the questions, I was thinking, well, if I'm last, and there's four people before me, and they've said no one's done it before, and I come here and say, oh, Ian had done it, then I'm... the bad guy.
I do like to win, and there was a desire to bend the rules a little. It seemed like an advantage, and it would have been churlish to pass off on it.
20 years ago, it's entirely different, and peer pressure was very, very, you know, dominant in my life. And also, I used to worry like hell about what people thought of me and all that kind of thing. But now, don't care, do what I want, you know. I think it's age has plays a big part in that, you know. But I think with the younger kids, peer pressure is paramount.
But the pressure comes from... you just don't want to be the standout like that, just to go along. You just want to go along.
Well, I found that both interesting and disturbing when I looked for it and found it online. It's amazing that they really weren't under that much pressure, but they gave up, you know, the ability to be honest and truthful right away in front of strangers. So it was kind of sad. You notice that many of the subjects in the first two videos were fairly young, but they weren't teens. They're young adults for the most part. However, in the third one, some of the subjects are a little bit older, and it was interesting, the only one that remotely escaped the pressure, although she went along with it as well, appeared to be the oldest one in the group. When I first started watching this, it was painful to see people that were willing to lay aside their convictions so quickly. This experiment, as I said, wasn't anything particularly important in their lives. It was just a few minutes, but they were all based on the pressure exerted by really just one person in the last demonstration. They were all willing to lie. So you could tell that they did so under a certain amount of distress, but they still did it. So what does God show us about the handling of social influence that's exerted by others? Let's start by turning to the book of Genesis, and we'll go to chapter 3. Brent danced around this a little bit earlier, so let's make a few comments and a few observations about the book of Genesis, and particularly Adam and Eve. Genesis 3, and we're going to read... verses 1 through 7. Now the serpent was more cunning than any beast of the field which the Lord God had made. He said to the woman, "Has God indeed said, you shall not eat of every tree of the garden?" And the woman said to the serpent, "We may eat the fruit of the trees of the garden, but of the fruit of the tree which is in the midst of the garden, God has said, you shall not eat it, nor shall you touch it, lest you die." Then the serpent said to the woman, "You will not surely die, for God knows that in the day you eat it, your eyes will be opened, and you will be like God, knowing good and evil." So when the woman saw that the tree was good for food, and that it was pleasant to the eyes, and a tree desirable to make one wise, she took of its fruit and ate. And she also gave to her husband with her, and he ate. And then the eyes of both of them were opened, and they knew that they were naked, and they sewed fig leaves together and made themselves coverings. So what is God showing us here? You might argue that Eve was really not the victim of peer pressure. After all, the serpent, was cunning, and he really was not her peer in any sense of the word. But what about Adam? Eve was his peer, she was the peer to Adam. She was made to be his helper, as Brent read back then, and comparable to him. That's pretty much the definition of a peer. So pressure from Adam's peer Eve led him to sin. He wasn't deceived by Satan, as we read in other places. He chose to act with the knowledge that it was wrong. And if we go down to verse 17, we'll read verses 17 to 19. I shouldn't have closed my Bible here. Then to Adam he said, this is God speaking, "Because you have heeded the voice of your wife and have eaten from the tree of which I commanded you, saying, 'You should not eat of it,' cursed is the ground for your sake. In toil you shall eat of it in all the days of your life." And he goes on to make a few other curses as well. Now, God did not make any allowance for the pressure that Adam was under. He expected obedience. He expected that as a free moral agent, able to choose between right and wrong, that Adam would be able to make the right choice. He didn't excuse the sin because others, Eve, had an impact upon him. Now turn, if you will, to Romans 12, verse 2. And this is Paul speaking. He's speaking to the Romans. He says, "And do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, that you may prove what is the good and acceptable and perfect will of God." Now, the Greek word here, conform, means to conform oneself, that is, mind and character, to another's pattern. We're not to be conforming to the actions of those around us because of the pressure from them, but instead we're supposed to be transformed, that is, unwilling to act or think even in the worldly manner that of the people that we encounter. Did God know that we would sometimes have peer or social pressures that was placed upon us? Notice what he says in Exodus 23, verse 2. Exodus 23, verse 2. God says in the statutes, and this is right after the Ten Commandments were given, he says, "You shall not follow a crowd to do evil, nor shall you testify in a dispute so as to turn aside after many to pervert justice," which is kind of what these people in this last thing did. So this is a statute that God gave immediately after the Ten Commandments to Israel. So he acknowledges that we're going to be under pressure from crowds, from multiple people at times. Turn to Proverbs chapter 1, Proverbs 1. And go down to verse 10. Proverbs 1, verse 10, it says, "My son, if sinners entice you, do not consent. If they say, 'Come with us, let us lie in wait to shed blood. Let us lurk secretly for the innocent without cause. Let us swallow them alive like Sheol and hold like those who go down to the pit. We shall find all kinds of precious possessions. We shall fill our houses with spoil. Cast in your lot among us and let us have one purse. My son, do not walk in the way with them. Keep your foot from their path." So God is speaking and explaining that there's going to be times when we're put under pressure from others to do ungodly things. He expects us to not go in their way. You don't need to turn there, but James 1 verse 12 tells us, it says, "Blessed is the man who endures temptation, for when he has been approved, he will receive the crown of life which the Lord has promised to those who love him." Now, when we're pressured to socially to go along with others against our convictions, what is really happening at that time? Certainly, it's uncomfortable. You might say there's an element of fear involved, but it's not necessarily that we think we're going to be the victim of violence. but it's a concern about what somebody will think about us. We're afraid that we're going to lose social standing before others, kind of as we saw in those demonstrations. We might look silly or embarrassed. There's a kind of fear associated with each of those. But God tells us that we should fear only Him. Notice what He says in Deuteronomy verse, chapter 10. You don't need to turn there. Deuteronomy 10, verse 20. You shall fear the Lord your God and serve Him, and to Him you shall hold fast and take oaths in His name. And again, make reference to Proverbs 29, verse 25. It says, the fear of man brings a snare, but whoever trusts in the Lord shall be safe. So again, I place before you the question, are we able to successfully fight against peer pressure? Can we always? Could I do so? Let's look at a couple of examples real quick about the submission to peer pressure. There were quite a few examples in the Bible of people that were under social pressures from time to time. Certainly we just saw Adam and Eve. What about the patriarchs? Turn real quickly to Exodus 24. Exodus 24, this is right after the Ten Commandments and the statutes were given. And we'll start in verse 6. And Moses took half the blood and put it in basins, and half the blood he sprinkled on the altar. So he was he just ratified the commandments with the people. And going down to verse 9. So then Moses went up also with Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, those were the sons of Aaron, and 70 of the elders of Israel. And they saw the God of Israel, and there was under his feet, as it were, a paved work of sapphire stone, and it was like the very heavens in its clarity. But on the nobles and the children of Israel, he did not lay his hands, so they saw God, and they ate and drank. Now that's pretty amazing. They actually saw God, so they certainly couldn't help but have been inspired by what they saw and by the activities, hearing God's voice and so on. So let's pick up this story in chapter 32 and in verse 1. Now, by this time, Moses had gone up to the mountains and he left Aaron and the elders down below, as we remember. In chapter 32, verse 1, now when the people saw that Moses delayed coming down from the mountain, the people gathered themselves together to Aaron and said to him, come, make us gods that shall go before us. For as for this Moses, the man who brought us up out of the land of Egypt, we do not know what's happened to him. And Aaron said to them, break off your golden earrings, which are in the ears of your wives, your sons, and your daughters, and bring them to me. So all the people broke off the golden earrings, which were in their ears, and brought them to Aaron. So Moses being delayed, at least a little longer than what were expected, they've now made this request of Aaron. Now he was a leader of Israel. You could say he was the second in charge just behind Moses, humanly speaking. And God had used him to accomplish some great miracles back when they were in Egypt. In addition, he had just heard God's voice and witnessed his power. You would imagine at that point that his faith and his resolve would have been quite strong. But as we saw in verse 12, Aaron succumbs quickly to the desires of the people. Why was it? Why was the influence of hundreds, and again we might say there were thousands perhaps, that were clamoring for this ungodly request? I've read this many times before, and I can't see any viable explanation other than that Aaron was simply under social pressure, you could say, and he simply gave in. Rather than act on his faith and the convictions and tell them no, he just gave in. Go down to verse 21. And Moses said to Aaron, what did this people do to you that you have brought so great a sin upon them? So when Moses heard it, he had the exact same question. Why is it you did this? Verse 24 through 26. And I said to them, Aaron speaking, whoever has any gold, let them break it off. So they gave it to me, and I cast it into the fire, and this calf came out. Now when Moses saw that the people were unrestrained, for Aaron had not restrained them to their shame among their enemies, then Moses stood in the entrance of the camp and said, whoever is on the Lord's side, come to me. And all the sons of Levi gathered themselves to him. So again, we see that even though he was a leader, he gave in to the pressure. And again, Would we have acted differently? Certainly we hope we would have. Let's look at real quickly one more example. Last week, Mr. Ost gave a sermon on the events that took place in Acts 10 involving Peter and Cornelius. And he explained that God had showed Peter from visions that both he and Cornelius experienced that God was calling Gentiles into his church. And the conclusion was that circumcision was not required for conversion. And without going into chapter 11, you can read it further, Acts 11, or you can listen again to the sermon. He explained this information to the Jerusalem church, and they were convicted as well by what Peter had said. You can make note of Acts 11, verse 18, where the church itself acknowledged that this was a new truth. But there must have remained some people in Jerusalem among the Jewish church members there that were not really convinced. Now turn to Galatians 2. Galatians 2, written by Paul. And he's going to relate an episode that involves Peter. We'll start in verse 11. Galatians 2, verse 11. Paul speaking. He says, "Now when Peter had come to Antioch, I withstood him to his face, because he was to be blamed. For before certain men came from James, For before certain men came from James, he would eat with the Gentiles. But when they came, he withdrew and separated himself, fearing those who were of the circumcision. And the rest of the Jews also played the hypocrite with him, so that even Barnabas was carried away by his hypocrisy." So just as Aaron had done, it appeared that Peter didn't act on his convictions, even though he had just had shortly before that, or sometime before that, a miracle performed that God showed him. Instead, in this particular instance, it appears that he yielded to people that had come from Jerusalem that had a difference of opinion. And this is clearly, if you read the events, you'll see it's clearly after the events of Joppa and after it had been reported to Jerusalem. So again, it seems like the pressure exerted by the people that were from the circumcision party was so great that it caused Peter to act hypocritically. And that's what Paul says in verse 14. Now, there's quite a few other examples. I'm sure you can even think of some as well. You might just make mention in your notes. In Matthew 14, King Herod appeared to have been pressured into beheading John the Baptist. And further, in Mark 15, verse 15, Pilate, at least in part from pressure from the Jews, turned Christ over to the crowd. And I'm sure you can find others examples as well. Now, there's also examples of people who stood firm in the face of peer pressure. One you can think of is Noah, and we won't go there and read that story, but obviously for what appears to have been 120 years, Noah, while he was building the ark, must certainly have encountered ridicule and laughter on the part of people that came and watched what he was doing. But he didn't submit to it. We have no evidence that it deterred him from doing exactly what God said. Now, we will turn to one example, and it's one you've probably already thought of. It's in the book of Daniel. So if you turn back to Daniel, and it's in chapter 3, and we'll read Daniel 3, verses 1 and 2. And I think you most of you know the story. Nebuchadnezzar the king made an image of gold whose height was 60 cubits and its width 6 cubits. He set it up in the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. And King Nebuchadnezzar sent word to gather together the satraps, the administrators, the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the judges, the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces to come and to the dedication of this image which King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. So it appears that virtually the entire administration of his government had been called to this event. And they're all standing there listening to what he says. Now, I've been in corporate meetings where a couple of thousand of managers have been, and high-ranking officials, much higher than I was, were gathered together. And occasionally top executives stood before us on the podium and made pronouncements about the company that I work for. And I'll admit there were times when I didn't particularly like what I was hearing. I just forced myself to listen. And when the audience applauded, I kind of did so politely, not very enthusiastically. But I was never singled out. No one ever seemed to notice that I was not enthusiastically buying the company line that was being discussed that day. If they had, and the president or the CEO had put me on the spot and pointed me out, I'm not sure what a difficult time I might have had. So consider what these three men were facing. Their names were publicly presented. They were identified as not being with the program. The king himself made a threat before these three men with all their friends, their co-workers all gathered around them, staring intently, no doubt. And look at verse 12 through 14. He was told that certain Jews that you've set over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, these men, O king, they have not paid due regard to you. They have not do not serve your gods and worship the gold image which you have set up. Then Nebuchadnezzar, in rage and fury, gave the command to bring these three men out. So they brought them before the king, and Nebuchadnezzar gave them another chance to recant and do what he asks. Going down to verse 16, they answered and said to the king, O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. If this is the case, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us from your hand, O king. But if not, let it be known to you, O king, that we will not serve your gods, nor will we worship the gold image which you have set up. So to me, this is kind of the height of peer pressure to have a lot of people, thousands even, of your own peers staring at you, all expecting you to act in a way that you know is wrong, and they firmly stood up. Besides what Christ endured, I think this is perhaps the greatest biblical example of standing firm in the face of social pressure. They didn't waver at all. They may have perhaps considered this situation before they went and already made a resolve to follow. So we start to wrap up this message. Let's quickly look at four points that can help us remain true and resist the pressure that can be exerted by others that we're surrounded by and that could ultimately lead us to compromise our beliefs. So the first point I have is be aware of the capacity of human nature to follow. We read this verse before, so you don't need to turn to it. God knows our human proclivities, or he would not have said again in Exodus 23, verse 2, you shall not follow a crowd to do evil. The second point is be careful when choosing your friends and, where possible, your associates, especially those that you spend social time with. Notice the advice that Solomon gave us in Proverbs. Again, you don't need to turn there. You can make note of Proverbs 13, verse 20. Solomon said, he that walketh with wise men shall be wise, but a companion of fools shall be destroyed. And Paul also says in 1 Corinthians 5, verse 33, he says, do not be deceived. Evil company corrupts good habits. So we surround ourselves with people that are of low moral character. The pressure that they may exert on you is going to be a very difficult thing to avoid. Point number three, as much as possible, avoid putting yourself in situations that could potentially be difficult to handle. Again, you don't need to turn there. I'll make reference to two scriptures in Proverbs. Proverbs 22, verse 3 says, a prudent person foresees the danger and takes precautions. The simpleton goes blindly on and suffers the consequences. So this is saying that if you have the opportunity and can perhaps discern that there is going to be a problem, you should certainly take steps not to put yourselves in it. And Proverbs 4, verse 14 and 15, read it in the English Standard Version, it says, do not enter the path of the wicked, and do not walk in the way of evil. Avoid it. Do not go on it. Turn away from it and pass on. And fourth, the fourth point I have is, if you find yourself in difficult situation, in a difficult situation, and certainly from time to time it's probably unavoidable, we will during our lives, immediately go to God for help. Remember what he inspired Peter to write. In 2 Peter 2, verse 9, Peter says, "The Lord knows how to deliver the godly out of temptations." And in 1 Corinthians 10, verse 13, Paul writes, "No temptation has overtaken you except such as is common to man. But God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you are able, but with the temptation will also make a way of escape, that you may be able to bear it." Now, before we end this sermon, there's just one other point I might want you to consider. We need to be careful that we do not ourselves exert undue pressure on another person, especially a fellow Christian. As Paul described in Romans, in chapter 14 of Romans, we could inadvertently be putting a type of peer pressure on a brother or sister because of what we might understand, but someone else, perhaps a new person, weak in the faith, may not. So let's keep others in mind at all times. So in conclusion, brethren, we never know when you're going to face some kind of social pressure. We've seen examples of how even in simple activities that people can be pushed to try to conform with a crowd. Even as Christians, we're not exempt from being pressured, but God expects more of us. He expects us to resist what others around us may be doing. Let's be prepared to resist the pressures from this world society and remain faithful to God. If we do, someday soon we'll be living in an age where the pressure exerted by society will be towards obedience to God. And what's more, we'll be helping raise up that new society, the kingdom of God.